right, so we're back with John Ramirez. Last time we had you on, it was for the exclusive video of your presentation titled Navigating the US Intelligence Community for Ufologists. And that presentation was extremely popular. I think it's the second most watched video on my channel now. It's coming in at about 53,000 views, still going up. Wow. For anyone who hasn't watched it, there'll be a link in the description box below, so you can always check that out. But since then, you've made the rounds on a few different podcasts, and I wanted to get you back on for two reasons, really. One, to go a little deeper into your personal experiences with the phenomenon and how that's affected you and your kind of perspective on that. But also definitely to comb back over some of the responses you've given to your most recent interviews that I think are worth going over again. Mm-hmm. But I think it'd probably be good to start off with a little bit of a exclusive, something that you mentioned to me privately, which you've agreed to talk about on the record, which is that you contacted the CIA to gain access to your medical records. And that was to document the discovery of a precise surgical incision in your right nostril. And this led to some inquiries within the agency. Is that right?
Yes, I did reach back to the agency because it's part of this whole hybrid controversy that people question whether the actual meeting happened and whether I'm just telling a story, what was the truth behind it. And I wanted to combine my medical records of something CIA might have found that they thought was unusual, combined with the hybrid story. And it's an ongoing process. And so unlike a FOIA or even going through what I did with the presentation, the pre-publication classification review board, this is a direct entry into CIA to the privacy coordinator. And the privacy coordinator deals with former officers and current officers seeking to get records about themselves in their service with CIA. So I went through that route and I did get a response back, not my medical records, but they acknowledged that I did request these records and they are working on it. So that's where we're at right now. And so what I'm going to do is follow up with what we call a HIPAA request, which is just the release authorized by me of my medical records to a doctor. And it's been suggested to me that that might be a better way to prompt their response, that I'm not just getting the records for myself, but it's going to a doctor. And so it'll be from the Office of Medical Services at CIA to a physician that I know. And so that direct transfer of the medical records to another physician, and then my personal physician that can interact with me, CIA might be more comfortable with that. And that's where we're at right now with that process.
Right. And this is in some, it's connected to your understandings of perhaps having some form of an implant. Is that correct?
That is what I feel is the reason why it garnered such interest at CIA. It was basically just a medical visit. I fell down on my back as I was reaching for a Kleenex tissue to take care of a nosebleed. And these chairs have wheels, they roll back, and I missed the chair and did not miss the floor, unfortunately. So I was flat on my back. My coworkers were concerned about that. They called medical services. They put me on a gurney and took me up to the clinic, where they examined me. Now, I thought it would be just a routine exam. Understandably, they took the x-ray just to check my spine because I did fall down on my back and everything was fine. But they did say that they saw evidence of an accident or some other major surgery that happened to me in the x-ray. And I go, I don't think so. I never had any surgery whatsoever in my life. I still have all my wisdom teeth. I have my tonsils. Nothing was taken out of me. But they said that, well, this one doctor said that we saw something unusual. And then they treated the nosebleed issue. And so I was lying down and they shined a light, one of these long, you know, examination lights that they can see inside. And they said, oh, there looks like, have you ever had surgery in your right nostril here. We see something. And I go, no, I've never had any kind of surgery whatsoever, including the right nostril. And so they said, well, there's something interesting here. And they looked around a little more and I said, I'm going to get a colleague if you don't mind. I said, fine. And so this one doctor gets a colleague and they come over back and say, well, we have this patient here and would you take a look? So the second doctor took a look and go, that's interesting. Looks like a surgical site. And I reiterated, no, I've never had surgery there. And then they go off and little have a sidebar conference. And then they come back and say, would you like for us to cauterize it? And so they cauterize it. But before they did so, they asked me if I had they had my permission to remove some tissue around it to clean the wound or whatever they needed to do. So they took some tissue around that area. As to what they removed, other than tissue, I don't know. But they did remove something. I don't know what happened to it. And then they proceeded with the cauterization.
Were these people within the agency? Was this a
CIA doctors? Yes.
Right. These are so. I mean, I don't want to like play too much of a fantastical card, but just out of some level of speculation, do you think maybe they were silently interested in the fact that you had this anomalous thing and wanted to take a sample to take away somewhere and have a look at? Or
in my mind, I think that's what happened because. The fact that the second doctor was called in to do a simple cauterization, one doctor can do that. And the fact that they had a discussion on to the side, which I was not privy to, raised suspicions in my mind that they found something. So that's why I wanted to get my medical records of that time to see exactly what they might have found. And I'm very curious to see those medical records because in my mind, it was just a simple procedure. Nothing in that record should be redacted. I should be able to see everything, including whatever notes they took of the procedure, unless they had a second record that did not show me where they kept their notes about what they saw or recovered. I don't know that. But
yeah. Well, I guess you would know better than me if they'd do something like that.
Yeah, I don't see why they would, but in the context of what we know about implants and so forth, that raises suspicions in my own mind. What did they find? Did they find anything of that nature within me?
So are you confident that you will get these medical records?
I am confident I will get the medical records. I'll be more confident if they have some assurance that it's going to another doctor.
Right.
And so I'll go ahead and do that process and just to facilitate their release of medical information.
Yeah. Well, so alongside being a career intelligence officer in the CIA, you've also been a lifelong experiencer by the sound of it, of anomalous phenomena. And I think we'd all, you've spoken about it a few times, but I think we'd all be interested just to hear about this in more detail. Could you take us back to maybe the earliest experiences you remember and just kind of go through it in the way that you would like to tell it?
I can go back to when I was like age 4, when I saw through my first telescope, the sky, the night sky, the stars, the moon, and having this profound feeling that I did not belong on Earth. I felt an affinity toward what I was seeing, that this is where I belong. And then when I moved to the United States, my mother stayed back in Japan for a while to learn English. She spoke no English whatsoever. And my father had my sister and myself with him. And we moved to my father's family in San Antonio, Texas. And I lived with my paternal grandmother there. And so right after that, then I moved with my aunt and uncle in Fort Lee, Virginia, which is near Petersburg, Virginia. And this was like 1958 and 59. So there was when I first saw what I thought to be a craft. I saw something silvery, somewhat of an oval shape, rising above the treetops. And I was with my cousins and our playmates, and I pointed to the treetop. Do you see it? And no one saw it. They didn't know what I was pointing at. They ignored everything. There's nothing there. You know, they couldn't see anything. I saw it. I saw it lift above the treetops and then silently move away.
So was it like a disc, a saucer?
It was more not a saucer shape, but more of an oblong shape.
Mm.
If you will, more like a rugby ball than a saucer. So it's that oblong shape. And as I said, no one else saw it. I saw it. And I didn't ascribe to it anything unusual other than I couldn't understand why my playmates could not see it. Then my mother arrived, and then we moved to Petersburg, Virginia, in our own place with my father and my sister. And there is, at that residence, is when I started having the experiences of being taken, as I describe in so many interviews, to this Victorian house and being examined by a doctor and a nurse, and being escorted to this house by a woman who was not my mother, and having those experiences on the first floor examination, on the second floor examination, and it occurred more than once, these experiences, which could they be a dream? I'm sure they could be a dream, but the fact that they were recurring and the fact that they spoke to me in reassuring tones that nothing, we just want to like examine you, nothing will happen to you, you're safe.
And they were human, afraid. They were human.
They were human.
Yeah.
They were human looking. And when I asked my mother about whether I had any kind of medical procedure at any such place like this house, she said, no, absolutely not. You never had any procedure like that.
And what kind of procedures were they?
They were basically, it's just examining me. I don't know if they had instruments, because in my mind, it was more like a very primitive, not primitive, but more like something I later identified as coming from the late 1800s, the Victorian era, so to speak, of the late 1800s medical office. The furnishings, everything looked like from that period.
And even their treatment methods and behaviors.
Yeah, it seemed like, you know, the uniforms they were wearing looked very much like when you see an old period piece from that, depicting that era. With medical people, they're wearing certain kinds of garb that was more related to that area.
If we say for the sake of argument that this was the phenomenon, it was some phenomena related thing. I mean, what do you think the rationale behind that is, using a Victorian era kind of almost simulation for you? I mean, have you given that any thought as to why that was chosen?
I don't know. It's just that it seemed like non-threatening.
Yeah, I guess. I mean,
and the town I lived in, Petersburg, Virginia, I lived on a street called West Washington Street. Mm. And on that street, keeping in mind, this was like the 1950s.
Yeah.
So a house that's 50 years old would be built according to the architecture of a Victorian house, which I describe, which in what I saw was an A-frame house with a turret on one side, on the left side, a turret with windows on the top. Wraparound porch. So it sort of fit the kind of houses that I saw as a student in first grade. I used to walk to school and pass by these houses all the time. And back then, you know, Victorian sounds so ancient, but in the 1950s, they were like quite conceivably, you know, a house that you would see. If you subtract 50 years from 2021, and then all of a sudden you're getting a house in the 70s, right? So it's not inconceivable that you'll see a house built in the 1900s still standing and occupied. In the late 50s.
So come to England. We're all living in about 300-400 year old houses, mate. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah. So I think my mum's house is a good few hundred years old. It's definitely haunted. But so you had these experiences, and remind me, how old were you when these were occurring?
I was 5 and 6 years old.
So from 5 to 6, you were having this recurring this recurring thing. So what happened after this?
Well, at 6 and 7, and I, it's hard to think back, and because we compress time.
Of course,
This was still in Petersburg, Virginia. So I knew it was between 6 and 7 that I still lived in Petersburg, Virginia. And we went to a department store, which back in the U.S., they were called Five and Dimes, because ostensibly everything was supposed to cost a nickel or a dime, you know. Of course, you know, that was just a name. And so it was a old-fashioned department store with books laid out in large bins. It wasn't like a modern department store, as we would say today. And this large book of bins, I always went for the books because I love books. And I was just thumbing through books, and I opened one book up that had the illustration of a primitive man and woman on the left lower corner of this page. And the woman was holding up her hands, and in her hands was a baby that looked like, not like them, but more like a modern baby would look like. And above that couple was two saucers, and one saucer was shining its light on the woman holding the baby up. And then I got this message in my mind, you know, this is where you came from. We made you. So it associated flying saucers with something to do with humanity's creation. You know, this is where you came from. This is who you are. We made you. I thought that was very profound, even for me. I kind of understood that, oh, wow, you know, this is, you know, the UFOs came down and created humans in my, you know, young mind. So I went to get my mother, who was shopping in another part of the store, to get this book. I just laid the book down flat on top of the other books, which were arrayed vertically. And so I laid the book down horizontally on top of these other vertical books so I could find it. Went to my mother, got back. It could have been more than like a minute or two. It wasn't that long of a period. And that book was nowhere to be found. I looked for everywhere. And I said, Mom, I can't find it. I had a book I wanted to see. I can't find it. So that was another experience I had. And the hits keep on coming, because as I grew older, I was interested in astronomy. I was always interested in astronomy. That's what I wanted to be. When people ask me, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, I want to be an astronomer. My parents bought me books on astronomy. And even in the second grade, when I was 7, I did a presentation standing up before the class. We had to like talk about a book we read. And I talked about this astronomy book and described all the planets. And they were asking me questions. And I knew how far these planets were from the sun and how far. I knew details that the teachers thought was astounding. Astounding for someone that's 7 years old. But I was just interested in the topic. And so my parents bought me a telescope, a 40 powered by 60 millimeter objective lens telescope. Took it out and was looking for some of the celestial bodies that were described in my astronomy book. And one that I wanted to see was the Andromeda Galaxy. And so I looked for it in Cassiopeia, and it was a cold, dark night. And so the stars would be much more brighter than in the summertime. We didn't have the heat causing distortion effects. So it was a crisp night. And there it was. I found a faint little a patch of something near the Cassiopeia constellation. I pointed my scope at it, and there it was. I saw the disk that was the Andromeda Galaxy. And then the message I got at that point was, feeling that someone up there was looking back at me, looking at them. Such a profound message that we're looking at you too. And again, the same feeling that I didn't belong on planet Earth, that I belonged somewhere else. And there I had the experience of I was left behind by mistake, and they need to come find me. They need to take me. Please bring me home, because this was not my home. Earth was not my home. As I grew older, I had experiences with actual beings. So the next experience I remember was at that point, I think I was like 12 or 13 years old. I remember being taken by the hand by these small beings. I didn't know about grays back then. I had no ideas what a gray was. I don't know if anyone knew what a gray was back then. And this was like 12 years old, would have been like mid 60s. And so these small beings would lead me by the hand underneath, under the ground. It was a cave. And I tried to like push away, but then they held on to me and said, don't be afraid. The same message, don't be afraid. There's nothing to fear.
And these small beings, did they look like grays now looking back, or was it something else? Or
they didn't look like the grays that is popularly depicted in Whitley Strieber's communion book. They didn't look like that at all. Their heads they didn't have the almond-shaped eyes. The eyes were more round, and the heads were not so pointy like you see in the communion book. They had like a rounded corners of their head were more rounded. It did come down, but not as sharply. It was all rounded, and they had round eyes, and I did not discern much of a mouth or any kind of nostrils for breathing as prominent as you would see as on a human being.
Can you remember the skin color?
Yes, they were like very, like not gray, but more, gosh, it's more kind of a very neutral color. It's hard to describe because gray can be a lot of things, but it wasn't definitely not green and definitely not flesh colored. And so it was more of a mottled, not beige exactly, but I would say neutral, some neutral color that didn't really stand out as much. So that's the way I remembered them. And they were very small. They were like at 12 or 13, I imagine, I don't know what my height would be, but they were smaller than me at 12 and 13. Right. And I'm 5'10" right now. So they were much smaller than me. And I don't remember much after that.
Have you ever spoken to Dr. Rebecca Hardcastle?
No, I have not.
Okay, she's I'm pretty sure she's still the director for the Institute for Exoconsciousness. She was the first person I ever interviewed, and I lost that interview before I properly had Project Unity up. So I need to get her back on. But she actually described a very similar thing when she was a child, of being taken underground by small beings. And so I thought it might be interesting to connect with her, because it sounds like you've had similar experiences. That's why I was curious about it, because it resonates very much with what she told me a while ago. And at the time I was like, wow, that's mm-hmm. wild. But now I'm hearing it again, so that's interesting.
So the next memory I have, I had a compulsion to plant sunflower seeds. I said this before, watching the sunflowers grow, because I wanted them to find me. And that's the theme I had growing up. Please find me, please take me away from here. And I didn't have a traumatic childhood or anything. Like, it's not like I was trying to escape from my family. I just felt like I wanted to be up in the stars, not on Earth.
Were you talking to your parents about this at all?
No, not whatsoever. No, I have a side story about that that's very interesting. And I'll get to that. The encounter I had after planting sunflower seeds was more of a traditional, what people will call an abduction. But in this case, I wanted to be taken. So I don't say I was abducted against my free will. Mm. It was my will to be taken. I was disappointed they brought me back, that I woke up the next morning with markings on my body. But I experienced being held in the hands of a being that was much taller. I did not get a good view of that being's facial features, but it was definitely like hands and two arms. And it had 2 feet. It was bipedal. It was walking around.
This is in your room at night, is it? Or
yeah, they brought already hands were like taking me up.
Right.
And in the craft, I remember the corridor or the hallway, if you will, was I guess this is called convex. So it was like that, and it was lit all around, but there was no lights anywhere.
That's a common thing.
Yeah. And then it was circular. I knew that because I could see the walls, you know, rotating around as we were walking around us, conforming to our path. And they brought me someplace where there was a flat table of some sort, and they just laid me down. And again, the reassurances, don't be afraid, you know, we're not going to harm you. And I don't remember much after that, other than waking up, and I had markings on my body. Now, before I said markings on my body, I'm going to describe to you and your audience, those markings were around my groin area, around my genitals. So whatever caused those markings, it was a circular, I would call it a circular rash.
Right.
Almost as if there was some kind of instrument or something placed against me that caused this marking or rash. It disappeared like the next day. It wasn't a permanent marking. So it was gone the next day. It didn't really hurt me or anything. I thought it was really strange combined with this memory I had.
Yeah. But you don't have memory of the actual specific procedures or anything.
No.
None
whatsoever about that. Now, the aside I was going to tell you about was around that same age, my father told me a story about his grandmother, would be my great-grandmother on my father's side. So my great-grandmother on my father's side was Cherokee Indian. And she told my father about the story of Atlantis. She said Atlantis was real and that it had advanced technology that was real. And so my father related to me, you know, there was a place called, I never heard of Atlantis. There's a place called Atlantis that had advanced technology a long time ago, and it's a real place. And your great grandmother, who was Cherokee Indian, knew about it and told me about it. And it was something that she was told.
Yeah.
Along the ways. And my father described his grandmother, my great grandmother, as she was sort of like very mystical. Like she's almost like, if there's such thing as a medicine woman in the Cherokee Nation, she's more like that. She was very mystical, very metaphysical, I guess you would call it in today's terms. So that was in my lineage, this Cherokee Indian heritage.
Right. Well, there's a lot to be said about the experiences that the Native Americans have had with the phenomenon. I mean, it's at least within what we are allowed to know, because there is very much, secretive oral traditions and the passing down of knowledge within the community. So there's only so much as outsiders that we can know. But we do know just kind of from either people interviewing individuals or just from a historical record that they treat it pretty much as commonplace. I mean, you know, they understand that these things are very much intrinsic with reality.
Yes, they do. And so I think there, you know, sometimes we look at myths and legends as stories, allegories.
Mm.
And I'm thinking maybe we should look at them as like history.
Yeah.
And look at it from that perspective. And then a lot of things that are happening now, what we call the phenomenon or phenomena, make sense. The high strangeness aspect to Westerners, Europeans, and North Americans appear high strangeness. But when you go back to the indigenous peoples of the old world and in Latin America, it's not high strangeness. It's part of their culture.
Part of the culture, yeah.
And
yeah.
So I think it like behooves us to like treat that as history, as a way of investigating the phenomenon.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I'm great. It's interesting that you brought up Atlantis, because it's something that's actually cropped up a few times recently for me, and I've always been interested in this idea, because I don't really understand the idea that Plato was using some sort of allegory to describe society at large and where it could go, because it's dismissed by skeptics as mm-hmm. him just kind of telling a tale to give people right. a framework of society and how it could right. fall into ruin. But he described the measurements of the place. He described in stadia, like the actual measurements, the geographic location, very mm-hmm. specific details. And you know, he was supposed to have got this information from, I think it was like his great, great, great grandfather, Solon, mm-hmm. the Greek mm-hmm. philosopher Solon. And the story goes there that, you know, he traveled to the city of Sais in Egypt mm-hmm. and spoke to the sages and the mystics of the Sais temples. And they were the ones that told him that, you know, you don't know any of your own history. It's, mm-hmm. you know, there's been rise and fall of empires beyond your time. And so I think that there's definitely something there with Atlantis, and I find the Rickard structure, the Eye of the Sahara, that's one of the top candidates for some people in terms of a location of Atlantis. You know, the Eye of the Sahara, yeah, the Rickard structure. Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it. Yes.
Yeah, there's some CIA files on the Rickard structure. They have, mm-hmm. they did some electromagnetic kind of readings of the place, and I thought it was quite interesting that they actually had some previously classified files on the Rickard.
Yes, and usually it's something that might have been picked up by our sensors as a disturbance of the sensor, mm-hmm. and so many of the phenomena kind of goes back to a disturbance in the sensor.
Right.
What is going on? And so I told the story about the light energy orb working group.
Yeah.
It was originally a disturbance. You know, we saw something in our imagery that looked like some kind of disturbance or anomaly, mm-hmm. and we need to investigate this. And so that's happened a lot. I talked about the South Atlantic anomaly and the Bermuda Triangle as being an area of another electromagnetic high strangeness, to the point that unless a satellite is hardened against this phenomenon there, that the electronics will be malfunctioning over that region. So either before we had to turn off the electronics and we harden it for this phenomena, and then now we're more cautious as we fly over that area. It's something to do with electromagnetic magnetism. Emanating from the earth for whatever reason. It could be natural. I mean, I give that to the skeptics and debunkers. It could be a natural thing. But then, you know, it bears more research.
Yeah.
Is this what's happening at Skinwalker? Is there an electromagnetic?
Exactly. Yeah.
Phenomenon yeah, that work.
That was the next place on my mind, Skinwalker. So, going back to your experiences, is there anything else that jumps out as a notable experience going forward? Yeah, you've got quite a few.
many. In high school, I had an experience. It's a dream, but it's a very unusual dream. Mm. And there's an interesting aside to that too. So I had this dream of being in a astral celestial place. I can't describe it. But I wasn't in corporeal form. I was in light form, some kind of light being form with others of my kind. And I was very happy there, because within this context, I told myself, finally, I made it home. This is my home. I don't want to go anywhere. This is such a beautiful place. I don't want to leave. But then a voice came to me on my right side. This voice said to me, "It's time for you to go back. You have work to do." And I protested. "I don't want to go back. I like it here." But no, you have work to do. And so yeah, here is I was presented with a landscape. And in that landscape, I call it a landscape, but imagine like a giant carton of eggs. You know, you have little eggs in their little little pockets. But it's like infinite. It goes out forever. And instead of a white egg, you see little swirls of light in these little spherical structures. And I was flown over all of these little structures of light that were shaped like a ball or like a sphere. And I was told, again, by this voice on my right side, you can pick who you want to be this time. Pick who you want to be. And I flew over and I saw one that attracted my attention. And it was blue and white swirling like clouds inside this sphere that I could see through. And when I looked into it, I could see this individual's entire life from birth to death. And I said, I want to be this person. And the voice said, go forth, be that person, go in. And so I felt myself going into this sphere of light, and then immediately remembered being born. And the entire process of being born, to the point that I heard the doctor's voices.
Wow.
Vividly remember being born. So that was an unusual experience for me. And it was a profound experience for me to experience birth. But having experienced birth, I'm not afraid of death.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I believe I saw a life. People talk about life after death. I talk about life before birth. That there's a life before birth, you're born,
yeah. And
then there's a life after birth. Don't think of death as like the finality of it all. It's just a transition state that you'll be going through. So I'm not afraid of death. Now, here's the aside. I was an avid listener of Coast to Coast AM. And at this time, it was Art Bell who had the hosting duties at Coast to Coast AM. And he hosted something called Open Lines, where people can call in and talk about anything. And so I was listening to this, and it was early on in the evening, because on the East Coast, it goes until like 4 o'clock in the morning. But it was early on in the evening when he was on. And so I was listening to it, and a woman called and said, Art, I need to tell you about an experience I had. It may have been a dream, but I experienced it. And she, you know what she said? I was flying over this vast plane, and it had little spheres all over of different colors. And a voice came over my right shoulder and said, who do you want to be this time? Pick it. Pick one. And she described, I picked one, and I remember being born. And so I just want to say that. You can imagine my reaction.
How
electricity
many days,
in my, yeah.
Yeah. How many days after your experience did you hear this?
Oh, years later.
Oh, years later.
Because I was in high school when I had that experience. And then I was working at CIA, and I was living in my condo in Washington, D.C. And I know it was around a year. I remember I was still using Windows 98. That's how I remember. So I used to have a hobby of making my own computers, building it myself. And I remember I had Windows 98 SE, I think it was called, on my computer while I was listening to the radio. And so this woman said, I just wanted to, like, I needed to share this story. And when I heard it, my spine went like,
That's
electricity up and down my spine was like, and I try to get back on. I try to get on the air. I mean, you forget it, you know, Art Bell, when you try to get on the air, there's like stacks and stacks of call, and you're lucky to get on. And first time call the line, you know, call the number.
Yeah.
No, it didn't happen.
Wow. That is incredible though.
And so at that time, they didn't have what's called Coast Insider, where you can subscribe and then go back to the old recordings that he would put in his archive. So they didn't have that feature that I could like join Coast Insider and then go back.
I wonder if there's a copy out there somewhere in the ether.
Maybe so. I don't know.
If anyone knows what we're talking about here, then please email me and we'll get this back out there, because it would be so good to hear that.
I tell the story because I'm hoping that woman who told the story will be an enthusiast of the phenomenon. And if she hears my voice telling that story, I hope that in some way she'd be able to connect with me, because
yeah, absolutely.
That was more than it's the synchronicity more than
no. I mean, that's just like
that was the highest strangeness thing. I mean, even more highly strange than being taken up on a craft was this very yeah. tangible story that this woman told.
Yeah, well, just having it described pretty much verbatim for what you experienced, I mean, that's just phenomenal. And to be honest, the way in which you described it, I could believe that that's the way it is, that you can just observe which one you want to go into, and you see their basic storyline, and you decide if you want to play that character. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's definitely got its intense moments, but I do think life is kind of like a game. You choose who you're going to be, and you play through that, and you try and do your best. And once it's the end of that character, it's not the end of the actual player itself. You go off and you can choose what you want to do next. I mean, that's just my personal belief, but I feel like the way in which you described that scenario, yeah, that fits with me.
And the work I need to do is what I believe I'm doing now.
Yeah.
Because it fits with the other experiences I've had. In the interim, I've had what's commonly described as sleep paralysis.
Yeah, yeah.
And having beings in the room. For some reason, they like bedrooms at night. For some reason, they like 3 a.m. to 4 a.m. local time, wherever you are at.
Mm.
They tend to show up at that time.
Yeah.
And so the nosebleeds occurred during that time period between 3 and 4 in the morning. I would wake up with some like liquid forming around my mouth, and then I find out it's blood. And sometimes it's accompanied with like feelings of anxiety that, hey, I'm bleeding. Why is this happening?
Yeah.
And I've had this over a period of time, and I had nosebleeds ever since I was a child. These nosebleeds would occur. And so when I was having these nosebleeds, and being a believer as well, and trying to put it all together, I picked up a book by Bud Hopkins. And I believe the book is called Witnessed. And it's about the Brooklyn Bridge abduction of a woman, I believe in the book, identified as Linda. I don't know if that's her real name. But in the book, Bud Hopkins described that she and her family all had these right nostril nosebleeds, not left, but right, just like mine.
Oh, okay. Well, that, and you also have this strange scar in your right nostril.
Right.
Right? So there's something going on there.
Right, exactly. So that sort of like for me is another synchronicity, and not a coincidence. And so it'll be interesting to see if other experiencers have any kind of manifestation of any kind of strange nosebleeds, or even everything on the right side, like sounds in the right ear. Like I can hear sometimes wake up to the sound of something metallic near my right ear, like a metallic instrument that's flapping the wind extremely fast. And I've had those experiences as well. So again, this has been a lifelong period of experiences ever since I was a child to even present day. I still have visitations to this present day.
Well, yeah, I remember when we went on record last time, you said that your wife had recently seen orange orbs, right?
Right, over the Santa Catalina Mountains, and I saw a white one on my birthday in 2020.
And have you ever engaged in like a contact protocol to try and invite this stuff, you know, CE5?
I did a CE6, which is with Mark Sims using his radios.
Right.
And so I described in the Harmonic Convergence 2020 on my birthday, July 14th in 2020. He had a global gathering, no matter where you're at, you know, in over the United States, it's dark. He would tone and my wife being a singer, and also I see the guitar behind you, she plays guitar and used to sing and play guitar at various venues.
Nice.
That she would tone Hugh along with Mark.
What do you mean, and tone then, Hugh? Sorry.
He would sing Hugh.
Oh, right.
Much okay. like people would tone Ohm.
Right, right, right. Instead is there some sort of, is there a relevance to Hugh, or was it just selected as a...
I believe there is a relevance in a belief system called Ekandar.
Ekandar.
Okay. I may have got that wrong. I'm sure your audience will correct me, but Ekandar, I don't know, Ekandar. Or Kandar, I don't know how it's pronounced.
Right, right.
But Hugh is part of their observation, their practice
right.
of toning Hugh, and just what Mark was doing. And so after he toned Hugh, we were both meditating. My wife and I are both meditators. And I was looking over the mountains meditating and not really expecting anything. But there it was, a bright white orb. And to skeptics and detractors and debunkers, I know what an aircraft looks like. Mm-hmm. I know what an aircraft light looks like. I know what a satellite in space looks like when it's flying. I know what these natural phenomena or these natural things look like in the sky. And this wasn't it. This is something that blinked on, got really bright.
Yeah,
you can tell that it was a round or spherical shape. I can't say spherical because it didn't look, I didn't see a 3D sphere around it, but let's say round.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like shining brightly. It was just there. It wasn't like there was like a halo around it or like other streaks of light coming off of it. It was just there
mm-hmm.
as a light up in the sky, very bright. And then while it was shining, that's when I got the message, you have information you need to share. It's time for you to share that information. That's our message to you. And then it blinked off. So it's a blink on, blink off.
Yeah, yeah.
Coincidentally with the fact that Mark Sims CE6 is based on the CE5 protocol with the addition of a radio where he sends messages out through his radio.
Yeah, I was going to ask what exactly classifies it as a CE6, because CE5 is human initiated contact. So right. what's a CE6?
I would say CE6 is human initiated contact with the ancillary support of actually using a radio signal
uh-huh.
to transmit out. And then
okay, I kind of like, I don't know, because I personally think it's about consciousness transmitting out, and all space and time is connected and your mind is able to. So I feel like he's trying to create something that might not really exist there, but it's still pretty much CE5 by the sounds of it.
Yeah, he's done a lot of experiments with CE6. And if you want a guest for a future program, Mark Sims is a good person to get a hold of to explain that. He works with a gentleman named Jimmy Blanchette, who has a very interesting radio rig.
Right.
He actually transmits signals up to the moon and gets bounces back from the moon.
Oh, wow.
So Mark Sims and Jimmy Blanchette will be better able to describe the CE6 protocol.
Yeah, yeah.
It's based on CE5. And I do believe that meditation is part of it. So as far as, you know, kind of inviting the contact, the meditation part of that is definitely there. It's just that there's this electromagnetic sending a signal out.
Yeah. Well, I'm always interested because I've seen exactly what you're describing in terms of glowing white orbs in the sky that get extremely bright and then will, you know, kind of slowly close in. I've also seen ones that flash a few times as they traverse, and all sorts of white orb related phenomenon was the first real experiences I had before these orange orbs turned up. And of course you can probably dismiss maybe a couple of these things as satellites, but the frequency that I was seeing them in and the way in which they were displaying themselves, you know, at least as an amateur sky watcher for my whole life looking up at the stars, it was like nothing I'd ever seen before. But the one thing that I've never had And I I guess I feel a little bit left out. I don't really know why, but I've never had telepathic messages. I've seen these things. They've even floated down, especially in the orange orb form. They floated down and hovered above the roof of my house, and I was staring at them with my eyes wide open. But I've never had any sort of communication or a message given. So I'm always very interested when people have actually had some sort of direct messaging. And I'm not an experiencer through childhood. This is something that happened to me after I made a conscious decision a few years ago to start trying to do it, and it started to work. So I guess maybe I've just popped up on their radar. But you know, people that have had these experiences through childhood and then go on to have these messages, I find that really interesting. I mean, do you look back on this, and do you ever think about why this is happening to you specifically? Why have you had all of these experiences? Because there are a lot of people out there, like myself included, who have had experiences, but these are quite unique. It's the progression, the amount, and also the messages being given. I mean, I don't want to inflate your ego and say you're a starseed light warrior that's here to, but
yeah, I don't think of myself in those terms.
No, but it's definitely amazing. So I'd love, what do you think?
Yeah, I take it at face value. I do believe that everyone here is for a purpose, and it's just a matter of being awakened to that purpose in your life. And it may not be like telling everyone about your experiences with the phenomena. It could be doing something completely different in your life to help humanity. And so everyone's here for a purpose. But it's awakening to that purpose.
Yeah.
You know, have you found what you're supposed to do? The reason why you're here? I believe the reason why I'm here is to share my experiences with others, so that others who've had this experience, who may be more frightened by it or consider it strange and unusual to the point that they're not able to share with their family and friends. I'm a willing listener. I would be open to working with those people. I'm not a professional therapist, so I can't provide any kind of professional advice, but I'm just relating my own experience of the reason that you're having this is because maybe you're supposed to find your purpose in life. And then I refer them to resources I know about, like OPUS, Opus, a group of therapists who work exclusively with experiencers. I provide them with my own resources of how I learned to meditate. There's a wonderful woman in Vicenza, Italy, who I met in Charlotte, North Carolina. She's an American expat, has lived in Italy for over 2 decades. And she taught me how to meditate more effectively. And there's a YouTube channel she has where she offers her meditation modality. And I offer them, here's the way that I meditate, and things like that. And I've worked privately with individuals since I've become more known. The people have reached me through direct messaging by various means, and they relate their experiences. And it's an opportunity for me to provide them with resources they can go, because I can't like explain why they're experiencing what they're experiencing. That's something they need to come to their own self-realization, but I can tell them how to get there to that realization based on the way it occurred for me. So I think that's my purpose. That's my work.
Yeah.
And the fact that I'm talking about nuts and bolts, UFOs and ETs, to me, that's not as interesting as the actual message of why they're here, who they are. To me, that's more interesting.
Yeah.
The messaging is more interesting than the vehicle of that message.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree with that. And I remember you saying that you wanted to be in the intelligence community since quite a young age. But do you think any of this was maybe pushed by your experiences with the phenomenon? Do you think that played a role in where you went career-wise?
That could be. I mean, I don't discount that at all.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in hearing from other folks in the intelligence community who've had the experience. who had these experiences, whether they felt like they were led to or for some reason their lives fell into place through some synchronicity where they end up in this field. And just because you're in CIA doesn't mean that you're like all interested in UFOs. But I've met a lot of enthusiasts within CIA.
Is it quite common in the intelligence community for people to be experiencers?
I don't know if it's common, but when I make friends and we have our confidence with each other and we can share these private confidences, that they will relate to the fact that they are interested in this phenomena. They're interested in UFOs. In fact, we find that we're, you know, like I talk to a person and we find out we're both fans of Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah.
For example, oh, you listen to Coast, I do too. And so informally, we talk about this phenomenon. Publicly, within CIA publicly, that is not out in the outside world. I was the administrator of a Lotus Notes database called the Users Group. And long before there was any social media, this was like social media within the CIA. And so there were various technical topics, and a lot of it was like computer enthusiasts,
right,
who were interested in building their own computers. And we would compare what frame rates we got with a certain game based on whether we use this card or that graphics card, and what kind of motherboards we would like recommend to each other to try to get the maximum frame rates out of a computer game. So it's sort of like that kind of a technical database.
Yeah, yeah.
But in there, since I was an administrator, I start talking about, in one of the, I guess you would call them channels today, but one of the channels, I talked about more esoteric topics. This is more of a free-for-all. And I talked about the Anunnaki. I talked about the Monuments of Mars, which was Richard Hoagland's book at the time. And I bring these subjects up about remote viewing and so forth. And that started a dialogue in that channel where people will come to me and say, oh yeah, I was part of that remote viewing program. He wasn't a remote viewer, but yeah, I knew about the program because I was involved in the administration of that program or the analysis of the results of that program, whatever. Now get another, like another, phone call about, yeah, you know, actually, when I was in the Navy and during the Vietnam War, I was on this ship. I think it was the USS Chicago, and or I forget the name of the ship, but it was one of the big heavy cruisers, USS Boston. That was the name of the ship, USS Boston. And we actually fought off a UFO. And it said, yeah.
Wait, someone said that to you?
Yeah. Yeah, when I was in the Navy, yeah, we were in the Gulf of Tonkin and we fought off this UFO during this cruise. So really? And so...
Did it go into any more detail about that? Like in terms of fought off, they fired at it, it fired back, or...?
Yeah, it didn't fire back. It just, like, we chased it away. We saw it. It was not on radar because we could see it. You didn't need a radar to see it. And... like, where did it come from? Now, in hindsight, I would have asked them, did it come out of the ocean? Did it go back in the ocean? Yeah. You know, how did you guys, like, all of a sudden, this UFO, he definitely called it a flying saucer. It was a saucer-shaped kind of a craft. And the guns were fired. It was too close range for their missiles, but they were able to fire guns at it and try to chase it off. And so these are CIA officers who are relating me this. Relaying this information to me. So I found that to be, you know, okay, there's interest in this whole topic out there. And so that's when, you know, I got me a little gray alien doll, but it was actually green with the almond eyes. And I used to set it up on my computer. And everyone knew I was interested in UFOs.
Yeah.
Office of Security knew I was interested in UFOs. I went with a friend to these UFO conferences. Actually, I can say that in the first, Stephen Bassett had these X conferences. The very first X conference in 2004 at a Hilton hotel in Gaithersburg, Maryland. I actually donated $1,000 out of my own pocket, because I thought what he was doing, hosting these X conferences and starting this, what he called the expat, this public PAC, political affairs, political activities committee,
right.
related to UFOs. I thought that was an important initiative that I should support. And so I wrote a check and sent it to him for $1,000.
Oh, well, that's Stephen, if you're listening, that's where that came from.
Yeah, he knows. I already contacted him.
Oh, right.
To get his prior permission to mention his name in the context of the first X conference. And the fact of that, I donated $1,000 for it. And that was a very good conference.
Yeah.
I love this old conferences because all the giants that are gone were there. You know,
Stanton Friedman and.
Yes. And before that, you know, used to attend like the MUFON conferences at various locations in the U.S. And so who appeared would be like then John Mack was still alive.
Yeah.
But Hawkins was still alive. Roger Lear, who did a lot of implant work, was still alive. I mean, these were like Jim Mars. These were the giants of the time, Stanton Friedman. I was so inspired by them. And I actually visualized that someday, I think I have a story to tell too. And someday there would be a way for me to tell my story in some fashion to the rest of the public. And I can see myself standing on that stage. I visualized it as a reality. I manifested it.
Yeah.
And so I haven't stood on any stages, but.
Well, you're certainly on
on a virtual stage.
Virtual stages. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Plenty of virtual stages. So that's certainly coming to fruition for you. So it's kind of take a little bit of a segue here, but something I wanted to talk to you about. This is a guy that I don't really know a whole lot about, but he seems to be like the boogeyman of ufology. A few people in this research field think he's kind of pulling all the strings. And I'm just wondering if you can just talk a little bit about Ron Pandolfi.
Oh, Dr. Ronald S. Pandolfi. Yes, my friend met him in context that he used to come down to his branch. And Dr. Pandolfi had a friend named Al, that they used to pal around together. It was a good friend of his. And my friend, who's well-versed in ufology, went up to him directly and asked him, hey, I heard you're like in charge of the weird desk or UFOs. And Ron Pandolfi, he just looked at my friend and promptly just blank stare and turned around and walked out. Didn't respond whatsoever. He just promptly walked out. And I was chiding my friend, you should have asked me to, you know, if you saw Ron Pandolfi, you should have called me because I would like ask them more questions. Like, are you actually the are you in the aviary? Are you the pelican in the aviary? Do you actually know Dr. Bruce Maccabee and how do you know him? And is there really a weird death? I would ask him more substantive questions, actually, but he walked away. So I knew about Ron Pandolfi, and he was a brilliant physicist. He is a brilliant physicist. I mean, he's very bright. And when I met him personally, it was at a meeting. The meeting was in 2008 because I was in the Office of Director of National Intelligence, National Counterproliferation Center. So around 2008, I went to a meeting at a place called DIA, the same DIA you know, but it's DIA Clarendon. And Clarendon was a neighborhood in Arlington County. And in Clarendon, the DIA once had a building there that you can readily see on Google Maps or Google Earth. It had a pyramid-shaped top, a mid-sized building with a pyramid-shaped top. DIA was ensconced there. Some of its directorates was ensconced there. And we went there to talk about, we were talking about technologies other than UFOs. It had nothing to do with UFOs whatsoever. I can say this, that Ron was identified with something called Silent Sentry by Lockheed Martin. And Silent Sentry is not classified, it is unclassified, so I can talk about it. Silent Sentry was a technology to track vehicles in US airspace that could not be tracked otherwise by radar. for whatever reason, that they had some high counter stealth capability and the radar would have difficulty tracking. His idea was that if you put enough electromagnetic energy out all over the United States, and then you start collecting and sampling that energy all over the United States, that you should be able to see some kind of interference wake occur electromagnetically with something that's traveling across the United States at a very fast rate. And so that's the context I knew him in. In this very small meeting, it must have been like maybe a dozen people at that point. And I never got a chance at that meeting to talk to him about the aviary and whether he was the Pelican, not in that context. I didn't want to embarrass him because we were all together in this meeting. And so I couldn't get him alone to talk about it. But that was the context I knew him in. Silent Sentry is something you can look up. And you can Wikipedia is your friend. So you can look up something called passive coherent location. And that's the technology basically that was discussed. And you can look up something else, smart dust. That's also unclassified now. Smart dust. S-M-A-R-T, dust.
Yeah.
It's imagine being able to sprinkle something on something that you know the characteristics of, and then because you know the characteristics of what you're sprinkling on an object of interest, that being able to detect that object of interest in the presence of something you're shining on it, for example.
Right. Okay.
Electromagnetically or electro-optically, and this thing, which is can't be like readily discerned by human eyes, but because you know the characteristics of and you then invoke a response from it, that then you can track items of interest. And those items might be illicit items of interest.
Right, right. So if you wanted to kind of sprinkle a cartel's drug cache that was going across, you know, the ocean, you could use smart dust or something like that. Is that the kind of real world application, or what
you
exactly?
You said it, Jay. I can't. Use your imagination.
Okay, yeah. Little sprinkle of smart dust, and we've got our eyes all over you.
Yeah, but smart dust is something that you can Google or Wikipedia.
Okay.
So it's not classified. You can read all about smart dust.
That's interesting.
And you can read about passive coherent location, and you can find something about the silent sentry that Dr. Pandolfi was interested in.
So he's certainly a very, very brilliant mind. It's interesting because there's just so much mystique around this guy. I mean, I haven't done a lot of research, but so many people, when you mention Ron Pandolfi, it's a bit like mentioning, you know, like he who must not be named. Everyone kind of panics and says, "Oh no, you shouldn't talk about him on the record. Your video will get shut down." Or there's like this very strange mystique around Ron Pandolfi. So I don't actually know where all of that generates from. I don't know if you know the history of how he became such a...
I don't know that, because when I met him in person, he was a very personable person. I mean, he was like a nice guy. It's a guy that you can have a pint with at a pub.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, he's a nice guy.
Probably just been blown out of proportion as the
I don't know where that came from. I don't know where that came from at all. And what's attributed to him as a position at CIA does not exist.
Right.
Say that
right.
Much.
Yeah.
He was not
so far as you're aware.
Right. No, there's no such position as the deputy director for the Division of Science and Technology.
Okay.
No such position. He was a senior scientist. I believe in the Science and Technology Directorate. He was definitely that. He was never the deputy director of anything that I know of, because he chose the technical career path. In CIA, at a certain point, you make a decision. Do you want to stay technical or you want to go managerial?
Right.
And you can make that decision. I chose managerial. So I get away from the technical analysis, which means I had less fun with gadgets and more fun with Excel spreadsheets.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That's a lot of fun, right? So my guys had all the fun. And what I was doing is, you know, finding the money so they can have fun. Writing the authorization so they can spend money to go to hotels and get airline flights and get meals when they go to these fun conferences.
So what made you decide to go managerial instead of technical?
I decided that it was a good point in my career to do so.
Right.
I just wanted to do that as a broadening experience.
Right, right.
And I'm glad I did, because in the managerial side, you see more of how the sausage is made in the intelligence community, how budgets are created. And so I got in a position where I was creating the budget. They would come to me and say, what is your research plan for the next fiscal year?
Right.
The research plan is basically projects that you want to do. So I could drive the projects.
Wow.
I could put money into things that I thought we needed to get done.
Right.
In my field of technical electronic intelligence within the CIA context. So I was the driver of these programs. And then my responsibility was to write them up to the point that it's a compelling case where you can get money from Congress to put into these programs. And so the money went to the CIA, and from CIA, here I got these programs, and said, okay. And so all my programs were budget line items in the budget.
Right.
That's within the CIA context. Later, when I worked with the ODNI, mm-hmm. At that level, that's when I saw what that would look like throughout the intelligence community from a black budget perspective. So that right. was an eye-opening. I could not have seen that as a regular analyst. But
right.
in that managerial capacity that I was at in the National Counterproliferation Center, one of my responsibilities was collection strategists and requirements.
Right.
What kind of collection do we need to address the counterproliferation nuclear, biological, chemical equities? What do we need to fly to do that? What do we?
Right.
What kind of sensors do we need? So that's when I was introduced to the black budget world and saw how that worked.
When you were introduced into the black budget world, and this might be outside of the parameters of what you're allowed to talk about, but were you exposed to anything that you would consider to be highly disruptive technologies that haven't been released into the white world?
Let's put it this way. When you get into that world, I was given a spreadsheet of all of these items.
Right.
And the study of these capabilities was formalized into something I can say because I put it in my resume for CIA to approve when I retired. It's called the Intelligence Collection Architecture. The architecture that is all of the intelligence collection capabilities of the intelligence community. What they're designed to do and where and how much money is involved in doing it. But the information is very scant, and it's in language that doesn't say, ooh, this is exotic technology
right,
we
right.
got from UFOs. I mean, it doesn't say that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's in other language. So you look at it and you're not really sure. You just know that, oh, okay, you know, this is kind of an interesting technology, but they call it this. But just from the title, you know, you don't know what it is. It could be yeah. like, to make the a point clearer, like what ALSAP stands for and ATIP stands for.
Yeah.
Nowhere in there that it says UAPs.
Exactly.
UATs.
Yeah.
You know, nowhere in there. And so it was sort of like that type of language when they describe these programs. You don't
yeah,
get.
Yeah, like high inside. Resonance gravitational generation
exactly.
method or advanced aerospace flight or something like that, you know?
Right. You don't get any of that.
Yeah, yeah.
But you do see the full breadth of
right.
The depth of everything we do and the breadth of everything we do. And I wanted to spell one thing. People think of rogue programs. There is no such thing as a rogue program. And here's why I say that. Because there were some very like classified things I was not read into. So I could not know anything about some of these line items. I was on the entire collection architecture.
Yeah.
I had no idea. But there was money attached to those. And that money came from Congress. The DOD and the CIA doesn't have printing. We don't have printing presses to print money to fund our programs. We go to Congress. And when we go to Congress, the people who give us money is the House Appropriations Committee. And within that committee, there's a special subcommittee called the Defense Subcommittee of the House Appropriations Committee. And they have insight into that black budget program.
But do you not think maybe, you know, there could potentially be something off the books that's using, and not necessarily the CIA, but just within the intelligence community, illicit channels like trafficking and drugs, arms? I mean, no offense, but the CIA's got a bit of a history with that.
Yeah, and those, somebody up above, all of our pay grades knew about that.
Mm-hmm.
And approved it.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. What it takes to do that is called a presidential finding. A presidential finding gives authorization to the Central Intelligence Agency to conduct covert operations. And that's not classified. That's just part of the process. You can look up a presidential finding, and you can also use the search term covert operations, covert actions. Presidential finding, and you see the relationship between what a presidential finding is and how that can lead to a covert operation or covert action. So that finding is necessary. Who signs the presidential finding? The president.
President, yeah.
Someone gives CIA authority. So there's nothing like a rogue program.
Right.
So
right.
What happens is
it's kind of like a loose thing, though. It's like, it's not necessarily a rogue program, but from the eyes of a citizen, it's like bloody illegal.
You right. You don't see the inside of that. You don't see the inside of it.
Yeah.
But that authorization is written in law.
Wow.
It's part of the National Security Act of 1947, as amended by the people's representatives in Congress, to allow CIA to do this. So I dismiss rogue operation.
Yeah, yeah.
What happens is that when it goes bad, all of a sudden there's a flurry to give top cover to those above our pay grades. Oh, right, that, right. He wasn't briefed. He doesn't know, you know, stuff like that.
Do you think there could be anything within the private sector, aerospace sector, that's kind of off the books maybe that we don't know about?
If they're getting money from the U.S. government, somebody in the U.S. government knows about it, whether it's an executive or legislative branch. If it's money, it's in a legislative branch.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And as far as the authority to do what they're doing comes from the executive branch. The Department of Defense, intelligence community, whoever, say, you need to do this for us, and we're going to go and get money for you from Congress to fund this program. That's the way it happens. And it might be a really tight body of knowledge restricted to a very small amount of people. And it's so small that if you're not read into it, you would think it's above top secret, but it's top secret, SCI, and a very small compartment.
Right.
And just because you're in the intelligence community doesn't mean you know everything. Just because I was in CIA, I can't address a lot of the questions people pose to me because I just simply do not know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I give the example, as part of this intelligence community architecture, we went to a meeting and there were like hundreds of people there representing all of their equities throughout the military and the government, federal government, civilian government. And there was a Navy officer there. She was there and she raised her hand to ask about a certain program that was in the ICA list. And I knew it to be a Navy program. And she was a Navy officer. And she wasn't a junior officer. She was like a captain. I guess that's an 06.
Yeah.
So it's not a junior officer. And this officer, she asked about this program, raised her hand, and someone said, oh, that's a Navy program. And she had no idea it was there. And her face turned red because she was a Navy officer sent to this. And the other Navy officers knew about this program and she didn't because she wasn't read in. So that's what we're talking about. It's so narrow.
Yeah.
That very few people would be allowed to know what's in it. But having said that, I'm very, very happy that in the NDAA for fiscal year 22, there is language that states that the Department of Defense shall not withhold any information refuse to answer any questions of any congressional committee on any special access program, anything like that. You will answer our questions
Do you think they'll play ball? Do you think they'll play ball?
Else we will take away your money.
So, well, yeah, I mean, money speaks, but do you think the DOD, I mean, surely there's probably people trying to find a very clever way around not revealing some of this, you know, especially.
Right. It'll be interesting to see if they can do a song and dance around that.
Yeah.
But in Washington, money talks.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
And you take away somebody's money, and I mean, take it away. There's nothing to budget. I mean, there's nothing. You can't pay your contractor anymore.
So what's your optimistic projection for the next few years with this amendment and the NDAA and where it could go? What's the most optimistic outcome in your opinion?
Public hearings.
Yeah.
I want to see public hearings, especially after that first, whenever the first 180-day report is due, which is due 180 days after it becomes law. And so it's Saturday. It's Friday. I don't know if President Biden signed it into law yet, but when he signs it into law, the NDAA, it becomes a public law. From that point forward, the clock ticks 180 days from that point, and 180 days after that, and 180 days after that, every 180 days, I believe the language states that there will be a report to Congress.
Yeah.
At that point, the Congress should hold closed sessions to talk about things that are extremely classified, but also hold public sessions to inform the rest of us of what's going on. And you said, well, that can't happen. But every year, the Director of National Intelligence does an annual assessment of the previous year forecast, the future year. So that's in public session, and that report is released to the public. Of course, there are more details in closed session, but that report happens. And so you can read in between the lines. It's really fascinating to read. If you've been in the intelligence community and you look at what Avril Haines released as the annual intelligence assessment, you can read in between the lines. You kind of know where the IC is going.
Yeah.
And so that's, I found that to be very interesting to read. And it's definitely and CIA, the focus is all on China now. They're dropping other areas to focus everything on China.
Yeah, you know, actually, this is something I wanted to bring up because I know you've gone over this, but for people that haven't heard it, I think it's actually really quite interesting and worth repeating. About the relationship between the CIA and other members of the intel community in China, because you know you spoke about this and you spoke about how a young senator, you know, was a kind of a diplomatic aide in terms of U.S.-China relations. Can you just talk a bit about this technological exchange situation that went on? And this is fascinating to me.
To a certain point, I can. And that young senator back then in 1979 was Senator Joseph R. Biden, Democrat of Delaware. And he talked to Deng Xiaoping about how this relationship with China would be beneficial to both of us. And so the Deng Xiaoping agreed, and then we were able to help build these facilities with the Chinese. Anything you do in China is going to be a joint venture. You don't come in there and do things on your own. You always involve the Chinese with the construction, and you also have a training component with that. Not only do they want to know, want to participate in the building of something, but they want to know how you built it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a training opportunity there, and the Chinese consider that very valuable. And so when these facilities were built, there was an opportunity then to have exchange of data, because at that time, the Soviet Union, put it in context, the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan. And so the Cold War was very much getting warmer. And we wanted the Chinese to be aware that, and we knew that there was a rift between Beijing and Moscow. And so we wanted them to be aware that, hey, not all of those Soviet missiles are pointed at the United States. Some of them are pointed at you, and here's where they are. And that got their attention. And so we were able to have this exchange of technical information between the two countries. It's one of the highlights of my career, I think, because it was a unique opportunity to work with them.
Yeah.
Here's the country that was supposed to be our mortal enemy, We were their enemy, and they were our enemy, ostensibly, in the public eye. But again, that's what CIA does. Our job is to, we don't make foreign policy, but we do execute the strategic foreign policy of the United States through our relationships with countries with whom the State Department cannot have a relationship at that level. So that was an opportunity to then study Russian missiles because they were closer to the impact points across the border. And I can say that much. It was definitely like close to the border because when you collect signals, you got to be close. So it's not like from space, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We learned a lot about Soviet systems using that. And as when the Soviet Union fell, and I want to think that what we did in China helped end the Cold War, because the information we receive, not from space far away, but from the ground looking up, that data was crystal clear data. It wasn't fuzzy data, you know. It was really good quality data, and we saw more of it continuously, to the point that then, when we analyzed that data and processed it, we could discern the capabilities of Soviet ballistic missiles, and we can also discern where they were weak in Soviet ballistic missiles, where their weaknesses were. So when we go and talk to them about treaties, about limiting strategic weapons like that, we can present them with what we know. And they were surprised how much we knew about their systems. And so they knew that the game was up, that they can't, you know, do a song and dance and lie about the capabilities of their systems. Said, no, no, we know you can do this, but guess what? You can't do that, and we know it. And so that led to two countries, I believe, closer together in terms of like limiting strategic weapons of that nature. And so they were spending lots of money, trying to build up their strategic forces. And their ground forces, their air forces, their naval forces. They spent a lot of their gross domestic product doing that. And we literally ran them broke to the point that the entire system collapsed. And so that ended the Cold War. And so after the Cold War, they were extreme in a very vulnerable position, because a lot of their deployed systems were in the republics outside Russia proper. And so those republics declared independence from Russia.
Yeah.
And the funny story is that one of the radars I looked at was in Kazakhstan. It was called the Kazakh Soviet Socialist Republic back then, but it was Kazakhstan, an independent republic. And so this radar system was on their territory, and they asked the Russians to pay for the electricity to run this massive radar and all the radars that were in Kazakhstan to look at the Russian missile tests. These are the same radars that we were collecting from China. And so the Russians balked and said, no, we're not going to pay you. You know what the Kazakhstan government did?
Well,
it pulled the plug on all the electricity.
Oh, wow.
Those radars were offline, and they were offline for until the Russians paid up.
Wow, not even the government can skip out on their electricity bill.
You can't skip out on an electricity bill. So that actually happened. There was a period of time when those radars were offline.
Wow. This is again another interesting thing that was brought up in your talk with Unidentified Celebrity Review. This relationship between the CIA and Google. I wasn't familiar with some of the things that you were talking about with that.
Right, and it's all discoverable. I mean, you can Google it.
Yeah.
Ironically, yeah. Learn how Google was how Google received the Earth Viewer program. It was through another company called, I think it was called Keyhole, but it was a CIA program called Earth Viewer. And we were able to transfer it to Google. But the relationship occurred much earlier than that, because there were graduate students who founded Google. And there was a funding through a National Science Foundation vehicle to have these graduate students do their work. and it was through a grant to Stanford University, that Stanford University can then provide to these graduate students. Right. And so there were a few that caught the National Science Foundation attention, and by extension, the intelligence community learned about one of the, I think his name was Sergey. I think he was the one, that's his first name, one of the founders of Google. And so it cultivated a relationship with this company. Now, there were still students at the point, at that time, but later Google, on September of, I think it was 1998, I'm thinking September 2nd, 1998, and I don't know if that's a correct date for the founding of Google, but at that time, when Google was founded, before that occurred, I remember walking down to the lab, and at that time, I was upstairs working for OSWR. I walked down to the lab before Google was founded, and I was shown this search engine. And before that, we used something called Alta Vista. Alta Vista was the search engine we used. I think it came from the Digital Equipment Corporation, Alta Vista. But then I saw Google and said, that's a funny name. So yeah, we're testing out this search engine called Google. So, oh, that's interesting. And I don't think Google was formed back then when I was shown this, or they were just formed. But CIA got the search engine testing it out. So there was some relationship between the Central Intelligence Agency and Google. And whether Google was aware of it or not, and they may deny it today that there was such a thing, but you can document the fact that there was a program at CIA called Earth Viewer, which we used to look at NRO imagery.
Yeah.
And then there was a company called Keyhole, I believe. And that company then was able to market Earth Viewer to Google, and Google became Google Earth. To the point that, you know, they need data, right? What's good of a way to look at data on the Earth if you don't have satellite data? And that was the point where some officers in the National Photographic Interpretation Center decided to leave NPIC and work with a fledgling company for commercial imagery. And along with that came a few NRO satellites that were older satellites. And so now you have this company that eventually became Digital Globe, now called Maxar. But when they were Digital Globe, here are these two satellites from NRO with NRO technology in them, with retirees of CIA NPIC working with them. And they're, you know, start shooting pictures and Google start buying pictures. So everything Google has to show you as Google Maps, Google Earth, they're not from Google. They actually buy the imagery, mostly from Maxar Technologies, which has roots going back to the intelligence community again. But they are a legitimate company. They're not like a front company. Let me make that clear.
Yeah.
It's just that it was a way that
some collaborative efforts
disseminate some of that overhead imagery technology to a commercial company. So
just kind of jumping into one of the more poignant talking points that you've, you know, gone over quite a few times, hybridization and this idea of hybrids. If what we're seeing, because it definitely seems to be the case, if what we're seeing is a controlled dissemination of very kind of specific intelligence on the UFO issue from different areas of the government, and you know, to some extent, this does appear to be a rollout of carefully selected information. If we're kind of going checkpoint by checkpoint, how far down the road do you feel something like this is? In your opinion, is this something that is on the cards to be addressed at a certain point in time?
I would have to think so, but there's a lot of cards before those cards are played.
Yeah.
Because I mean, there's still people who don't believe that the UFOs or UAPs are real.
Yeah, we're a way away from hybrids.
That gimbals, the gimbal UAP is not real. That, you know, it's or it's U.S. or foreign technology. They're not real in the sense that they're unidentified aerial phenomena from somewhere else. And so we haven't even like convinced people of that. There's still debunkers and skeptics who don't believe they're real. And then recently, D&I Haynes said we're extraterrestrially to explain that they may come to us extraterrestrially. And so there's the ET word. And so a lot of people don't think ETs are real, that they're a figment of people's imaginations, that when we have these experiences with these beings, that it's coming from somewhere else other than those beings actually being from somewhere else.
It's
a figment of your imagination, sleep paralysis. Yeah, it's been documented medically. It's not real. You know, you're imagining it, you know, whatever the reason. But she said that word. And so it's a process. What I did was probably not expected by the government, because my presentation, I believe, caught those folks who are working this issue, the folks you know by name, caught them by surprise that CIA would release, let me say what I said, even speculatively say what I said. But I explained to them, when they asked, I explained to them, here's the venue, because I'm talking to people who are still cleared, who are working this issue in some quasi-official fashion. I actually named the names of the officers that were there, the sponsoring officer, the briefing officer, who are very senior, and the two officers that I knew that were there, who one of them invited me and the other one I recognize as a very senior officer, and described that there were like academics there, that there were .edu addresses in that sign-up sheet with a smattering of .ucia.gov addresses. UCIA.gov is our domain name for unclassified internet. It has nothing to do with our internal data. Our internal network is separated, physically separated from the outside network. So that's a whole different addressing system. But within CIA, we do have access to the public internet, and that's through UCIA.gov, those addresses. So they understood, like, okay, there it is, you know, that slide, which was like the second slide I showed when we were together before Jay,
was
the CIA disclaimer.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, saying that there's nothing here that's unclassified. We're not going to endorse what you say. We can't say it's true. We can't say it's false, but there's nothing unclassified about what you're saying. And the fact that I brought up that slide, it surprised them.
And these people that it surprised, people that I'm sure most of us are aware of, have they strengthened your belief in this hybridization idea at all?
Not in direct words,
right?
Not directly, but I'm just waiting. I'm just waiting. Come on, give us, throw out a little bit, you know. And so you heard Lou say something about 70,000 years ago, there might have been an invention in our DNA, or words to that effect. You know, little things like that. That come out. So I'm hoping that, you know, there's a long process before we get from the DNI saying extraterrestrially to the fact that, okay, we're all hybrids. I mean, there's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, well, we've only just really got past, not completely, but at least to some degree, we've got past the Russian Chinese drone hypothesis for these things. You know, you're not seeing that spoken about as much in the news, but we're a far cry. I mean, it's the same for me with this whole conversation of how consciousness interpenetrates this UFO issue. And there seems to be a symbiosis between consciousness and quantum mechanics that's represented by this issue. And, you know, I look at the projection of when that's going to be discussed in a mainstream format, and it doesn't exactly fill me with hope. It makes me think we've got quite a while slugging away at this before we're opening that. I mean, that's why I feel like I might be putting more faith in the grassroots kind of scientific community that's going to grow out of this, just from a general interest of what's been addressed by the US government so far. I mean, you've got the Galileo Project, and there's plenty of other private groups that are looking into this. And I think that's going to increase over time. So, I probably placed more faith in grassroots development from the kind of the academic and the scientific community with this. And I hope that through that, we can open up some of the more abstract sides of this that maybe the government's not going to want to disclose their own intelligence sharing on.
But I would encourage your audience to believe that the higher consciousness aspects of the phenomena is not ignored officially.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you get a little inkling of that through the Skinwalkers of the Pentagon book that was released. And you get an inkling that they're looking at the high strangeness aspect of the phenomenon that may have to do with some kind of consciousness link. I'm at loss to explain the hitchhiker effect. I don't know what would cause that.
Yeah.
That to me is eerie. I mean, I for one do not want to go anywhere near Skinwalker. I mean,
no.
I don't want to tempt it. Don't follow me home. I would tell it. I mean, stay away from me. But that apparently that has occurred. And why did that occur? I'm sure that's at some level is being studied. The Skinwalker effect of those who went there to visit there with their instruments.
Yeah, that place is just mysterious in of itself. I mean, it's not just UFOs. It's like a whole vortex of phenomena. I mean, it's just strange. I don't know how to even begin to understand what could be going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So is there anything else that you want to kind of go over before we look at wrapping this up, John?
Not really. I would say there'll be some when I get my medical records back.
Yeah,
that'll be an opportunity to dive into those records. I'm not squeamish about sharing medical records, as most people are. I want to be very open about my medical records, whatever they state. And so I want to show people what CIA found about that period of time. So, I mean, I would be happy to talk about my medical records in detail when they are released to me. I'm not going to post them, of course. So please don't ask me to post my medical records.
Yeah, obviously.
No one's asking to post yours. So don't ask me to post mine, please.
Yeah.
But no. I would be happy to talk about that. And so I wish somebody would look into the Intelligence Authorization Act for FY22 and do a comparison between the language of that act versus the NDAA, which has passed.
Right.
I do not believe the IAA has gone through a passage yet. I believe it's pending. Still. So, and what I'm doing now is I would just want to let everyone know that the NDAA has an expiration date where this particular office will close shop. So it's not going to be forever and ever. It says not later than October 31st, 2022. So the first report is due not later than October 31st, 2022. That gives it within the 180 days of enacting the report. So something has to be due before October 31st of next year and annually thereafter until October 31st, 2026. That's it. So you got from 2022 to 2026. At that point, if we want to include this back into a future NDAA or some other future legislation, it's going to have to happen sometime in fiscal year 2026.
Right. Otherwise, they can just get rid of it.
Yeah. So there is an expiration date.
Okay.
I did not read the expiration date in the IAA, which seems more open-ended. I didn't say, or if after a certain date, this expires. I don't know if that language is actually there in the original Gillibrand Amendment. A lot of the Gillibrand Amendment went away, which really upset me.
Yeah.
Because Congress cannot legislate a sole source contract. So when they called out SCU, which is not a government entity, when they called out the Galileo Project, which is not a government entity, and said, you will have participation from these two groups, they're not federal offices. And so Congress cannot legislate that you will have a contract with these entities. Now, the Department of Defense is free to let out a contract going through the federal acquisition regulation process to have a contract with them, much like how they started the contract with Bigelow.
Right, right. That.
There is a process. And for that process, it was open for 24 hours. We have a request for proposal, RFP, 24 hours and it closes. So Bigelow already had his language already set up and he's shot it through and said, okay, we got it. And so it's a fair competition. We let it out for 24 hours. And guess what? CIA doesn't have to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
CIA is exempt from, CIA is exempt by law from publishing the fact that there is a CIA contract. They don't have to reveal that whatsoever. It's not legally bound. It is not legally bound to reveal that. And it doesn't show up in the federal register as a contract that's pending. So the IA seems to have a lot more flexibility in terms of studying this issue long-term. So I have high hopes for the IAA. And I would say this, I've been out of the CIA since 2009, and it's my 12th year out thereabouts. If the IA starts and if they want me back in some capacity to help them out, in whatever capacity, I would be happy to go back into CIA as a consultant, not as an employee. And if I can do it at some level that doesn't require me to take another darn polygraph.
Right.
So CIA, if you want me back, no polys, please. I'm not going to sit down for another polygraph. But they can clear you for secret provisionally. They can give you a DOD kind of secret. That's just right. Waving the magic wand. And you can get a secret as long as I haven't been in jail and not a felon. And I haven't been in any of those categories. So, you know, they might be able to bring me back. But I'll be happy to work with anybody in government as long as I don't need a clearance.
On as a consultant on this issue? Or
yeah. In terms of the IAA, which seems to be more centric to CIA being a Title 50 type of legislation, I'd be happy to work back with them. Of course, when that happens, no more Zoom meetings with you. And
I know, I was about to say, don't do that, because then we won't.
My Twitter account will be shut down. Well, Lou has this up and running, but my public presence will be much more curtailed.
Yeah.
But if it helps in any way to have more information released to everyone else, and if it's like I don't do this for money or anything.
No, goodness, I know.
Gracious, I don't want all this exposure, I'd be happy to shut everything down if I can help them to help you understand what's going on.
Well, if you do have to slink back into the shadows for our benefit, then you know, it was great speaking with you while it lasted, John. But no, this has been a great conversation. Like I said, I wanted to get into some of your more personal experiences and just have a bit more of a chit chat than last time, because. I'm still just impressed by just how well you went through that extremely extensive presentation. I mean the proof is in the pudding, as we say, because it's one of the highest viewed videos on my channel. It's being talked about all over the place. You did a great job with it. I'm very excited for your second presentation. Is this something that you're still looking to do, this second presentation, and get those slides released?
I want to do that presentation when I get my medical records back.
Yeah.
Because I want the medical records to be part of that presentation,
right,
in the
right.
context of alien DNA,
mm-hmm.
Depending on what they find. It might be nothing in there. I don't know. I need to see that.
Yeah.
And then I can then go to CIA and then name names and say, can I name names of who was there? If not, can I name their positions? And let people find them for themselves, because I'm sure they do not relish the entire UFO community out there knocking on their doors. But I'll offer this to a journalist like Ralph.
Yeah, UFO, Leslie Kane, Ralph, maybe Ross.
If they contact me and they want to know who was there, I'd be happy to release that, because I trust them.
Well, there we go. We'll have to put some feelers out. Send Leslie or Ralph or Ross an email, because, you know, they're people that would get to the bottom of it if there's something to get to the bottom of. I put a lot of respect on those journalists, just like yourself. Yeah,
and maybe not Ross if he's an Australian citizen.
Okay. We'll stick to Ross.
Pine Gap. I'd be happy to talk about Pine Gap. There's a little bit I can talk about, but other than that, no. I want to either be Ralph or Leslie.
Mm. Well, best of luck with that, honestly. And like, let me know when you've got these medical records, and we can definitely look at talking about that, because I think people will be very interested if you manage to get back some data on that. But in the meantime, as always, absolute pleasure to speak with you, John, and thank you for sitting down for so much time to go over all of this again.
Yes, and for everyone in your audience, happy Christmas, and so happy New Year as well. And I hope 2022 will be. Gives us a little bit of edge toward more about the truth of what's going on. That's my wish for 2022.